I would like to focus today on characterization in the memoir. And to do so, I have asked John Griswold to read one of his very brief essays. John is the author of A Democracy of Ghosts, a Forward magazine book of the year. His essays, stories, and poems have appeared in McSweeney's, Ninth Letter, Peregrine, Natural Bridge, and elsewhere. The essay he is about to read is from the online journal Brevity, and was listed as notable in the Best American Non-Required Reading of 2009, edited by Dave Eggers. Now, normally I would not interrupt a writer reading his work to offer my running commentary, but in this case I'm going to do so, because I want to break down as well as I can the simple but beautiful ways in which John characterizes the people who appear in this memoir piece. So I'll let John read briefly from the opening, and then I'll begin to make my points. Oh, and by the way, I'm Dinty W. Moore, editor of Brevity, and if you want to read this essay, entitled Three Graces, it is available online at www.brevitymag.com. Click on Past Issues and look for Issue 28, Fall 2008. Now here's John.
Three Graces. In the Sunflower Cafe, the waitresses sat down in booths with elderly customers and watched them shuffle photos of grandkids like decks of cards, as if looking for a good hand. Some early retirees, robust, tanned, and laughing, described the waitresses to me as booze hags.
Notice how quickly John sets the scene, but also, simultaneously, builds the character of the waitresses as a group. You'll see more of how that functions later. But already we get these vivid impressions. First, of their kindness. They sit down and look at the photos of the grandkids, of the elderly customers. But also, at least through the words of the retirees, we see a less flattering aspect. There's nothing pretty about the phrase booze hag. Now listen to see how the author follows this up.
The women's hands shook as they poured coffee. They moved round each other in a practiced dance, hollered obscene jokes over the din, ministered with buttered toast. Three of them said they'd drop by to see my dad on their way out to the bars. They'd be off at 2, but were going to someone's house to shower and change first.
Again, these women are being painted in complex, colorful strokes. They move in a practiced dance. They minister with buttered toast. Yet the less flattering side is reinforced as well. Their hands shake. They holler obscene jokes across the restaurant. These characters are more alive than most precisely because of these seeming contradictions. They are not villains. They are not angels. They are not perfect, nor are they useless drunkards with nothing to share. They are who they are. Two more things. Griswold never says any of this. He gives us the details, plain and simple, and lets us form our own conclusions. Letting the reader form his or her own conclusions is always so much more powerful, just like in real life. You register a fact when someone tells you something about someone else, but you believe it when you see it. Well, it works that way on the page as well. So Griswold is allowing us to see it, so that we might not just understand, but actually believe. The final detail, the waitresses have promised to drop by to see the narrator's dad, and they are going to shower and change first, propels the rest of the story, as you will see.
My father and his wife ate breakfast there 6 days a week for 8 years. He had collapsed the first time in the lobby a month earlier. One of the Greek owners, George, stood over him, shouting to my stepmother, "It's okay, he's breathing, he's alive!" Now he was dying in a hospice room that had a view of a man-made lake with a fountain in the center. The nurses said to look for the resident gator, but the late sun made the water a mirror, and the blinds were kept shut. My father was glad to see them when they came in loudly, smelling of perfume, smokes, and the gin they'd had before they left the house. Their faces looked harder and more worn, the disappointments more obvious now they were made up to go out. They cooed and smiled, and one was missing teeth. They were very beautiful.
Here we go again, with the simple contradictions of these three women. the three Graces. They do show up, as promised, and the dying father is happy to see them. Yet they smell of smoke and gin, and they look harder in the late afternoon light. The narrator begins to characterize himself, too, with a simple line, "They were very beautiful." Of course they were. They were there cheering up the narrator's dying father. They were being kind. They were real. Now more.
They sat around the bed and caught him up on all the news from the Sunflower. George was still an asshole and took advantage. One of them had walked out after another shouting match with him, then walked back in the next day. A former waitress, whom my dad and his wife might have remembered, had finally lost everything, hard drugs, they said, and had gone away with nowhere to go. They'd been there half an hour before they realized my father didn't have the breath to speak. He was embarrassed and frustrated, so I told them about his work for USAID in Vietnam and Afghanistan, his job as an advisor in the tin mines in Indonesia, the sabbatical he'd done in Paris at a lost wax gold foundry. "Oh, isn't that interesting," they said. "You do get around, don't you, hon?" They could see he was tiring, so they said their last goodbyes. They were headed out to the beach, where there were drink specials. I had to go in the bathroom while they kissed him and patted his hands and said, "See you at the restaurant soon."
Very little is actually happening in this story, but the small details tell so much. The narrator, caring for his dad, stepping in and telling his father's stories because the dying man was too out of breath. The waitresses fulfilling their promise, but eventually scurrying off to where there were drink specials. And then, remember, this is a very brief essay, just over 600 words. And then the narrator, or since this is a true story, the narrator-author, moves out of the shadows. And George, a character we have barely met, takes center stage.
I had breakfast at the Sunflower one last time, the morning I flew home. The three were supposed to be working, but only two had made it in, and I said it was nice to see them again and thank them for everything. When I went to pay at the counter, George, who mans the register eternally, asked how much I wanted to tip. The bill was $10, and I said to add 5. George dismissed me. "That is too much. $2, that's enough," he said in his accent, and started to punch in numbers on the credit card machine. "No," I said firmly, "you've all been very kind." He was bald, with a fringe, in his 50s, and had soft-boiled eyes. We stood awkwardly while the transaction went through. "We are sorry about everything that has happened," he said finally. He ripped the receipt off and put it down for me to sign. "But what can you say? There is nothing to be done. We are born to die."
I love this essay for its grace and simplicity, for the fine brushstrokes Griswold uses on each of the six people who become distinct as characters, and for a simple depiction of the working life of a small Greek cafeteria, where life goes on, day in, day out, until it doesn't. Thanks for listening.